The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
As it pertains to American Indian legal affairs, what does the word termination mean?
Termination means a policy of the United States abrogating its word. I mean, it's as basic as that, where the United States, through treaties and other pretty solemn documents, said it would do certain things for the tribes that were here before population came. And at some point in the 1940s and 50s, the Congress of the United States decided that was just too much a burden to pay for one half of 1% of the population, and decided to abrogate that commitment. It was both tragic for the Native people, but it was dark for the United States in that, as John Marshall once said, great nations, like great men, keep their word.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Mark Trahant about his book, The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars, Henry M. Jackson, Forrest J. Girard, and the Campaign for the Self-Determination of America's Indian Tribes. So termination in its execution then meant that Native people no longer had their land.
It stripped away the governmental powers. The entire basis of federal Indian law is that tribes are governments and that these governments pre-existed the United States, so that there's a relationship between tribes and the U.S. as a government to government. And what termination did was it stripped away that and said, you're just like everybody else. You have no special rights. You have no special authority to govern yourself or to make your own decisions. Your property will be taxed, and you're dealing with very poor people. So once they said your property will be taxed, it meant the loss of great numbers of real property, both land, timber, and other natural resources. They picked the very richest tribes for termination, and those tribes quickly became among the poorest.
And it seemed like land and resources were being targeted once again.
It was a new way to get lands and timber was driving a lot of it. And really, in this book, I tell one of the great stories where it stopped. And that is a resource-rich reservation in Washington State is the Colville Confederated Tribes. And the Colville Tribal Council had agreed to terminate. And you had to get the tribe to agree, and they usually did it with promises of great wealth. And there was this one member of the tribal council who was just stubborn. And she followed the tribal council around wherever they went and said, you know, you're wrong. Termination will leave us poor. It won't do what you think it's going to do. And even though she was a minority of one, she'd pick up support along the way. And then in 1964, she was able to get the majority of the council, and they immediately rejected termination, and no other tribe ever had to face it. I think she's actually the greatest Indian leader of the 20th century. Her name is Lucy Covington, and she'd actually sell a cow to go back to Washington to lobby. That's how she'd raise money to travel.
The central characters in your book are Senator Henry Jackson and Forrest Girard, and you wrote, quote, the history of this country would be incomplete unless one recognizes both men and their partnership. So tell us about these two men.
Well, it was this really remarkable partnership. For most of his career, Henry Jackson, Scoop Jackson is well known, who is really one of the great names of the United States Senate. Jackson had, for most of his career, been supporting termination in one form or another. And there were kind of two reasons to support termination in the 1950s and early 60s. One was just plain greed. People, like the senator from Utah, saw a lot of Indian land and a lot of resources and wanted it. But there was also, and I think it's fair to say that good people supported termination because they thought that might be a solution to get Indians into the 21st century. And they thought if we take away these vestiges from the past century, maybe tribes and tribal people will just become the same as everybody else and bring their culture, but not their political aspirations. But it was a disaster. It didn't work even along those lines. And Jackson realized that. And the cynical view is that Jackson had decided to run for president and that he needed to have this thing off of his shoulder as a great liberal. But I think it was more than that, because he took real concrete steps, not just to change his position, but to change the policy of the United States. And one of those ways was his mentor was a guy by the name of Clint Anderson, another senator. In fact, he was so close to Anderson that he treated him like a father and married his secretary and was just very, very close to him. And Anderson had been kind of the champion of termination all through the 1950s in Congress, so much so that he hired a guy on the Senate Committee on Interior whose only job was to terminate tribes. And he wrote the termination agreements and was very adept at doing so. And Lyndon B. Johnson asked Anderson to head the new National Space Committee. And so he gave up Interior, which is a real prize in the United States Senate, and gave it to this really young man, Henry Jackson, and who didn't have the same seniority and would normally never have been given a committee chair of that stature. And but Anderson made him promise that he'd keep his staff intact. And so he brought his staff with this terminationist, and he was going along the way things had been. And Jackson decided he was wrong. And so he moved the person who was involved with termination to another job and went out and hired not just the first American Indian on Capitol Hill, there had been a couple of others, but the first one was some real authority, a guy named Forrest Girard, who had a lot of experience across Washington working for agencies ranging from health to Bureau of Indian Affairs, and in Congress as a congressional fellow for George McGovern. And Girard immediately brought stature, and he said, look, I don't want to just be window dressing here. If I'm here, I'm here to change things. And that's what began this partnership. One other thing I should mention is about this same time, you had a president of the United States who cared, Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon in 1970 did an address to Congress where he said it's time to resolve some of these issues, and that termination was wrong. And as president of the United States, he was committed to supporting tribal self-determination. And Jackson and Girard took that really lofty language. It's actually one of the great state papers of Richard Nixon. But they took that lofty message from 1970 and turned it into legislation. And the legislation included the Indian Self-Determination Act, the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, the Indian Finance Act. It was just one after another up through the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978. And it was a real time of leadership where the Congress was not just involved, but solving problems.
And I just want to mention here that Girard was a member of the Blackfeet tribe from Montana.
He was a Blackfeet, grew up on the reservation, grew up on a ranch, and then in time in Browning. And like a lot of young men from his generation, gained incredible leadership experience during World War II, where he was a very young man flying bombing missions over Germany.
And in charge of men much older than he was.
Yes.
You wrote that the 1970s was a special time for American Indians and Alaska Natives, which you touched on with the list of pre-legislative acts you just mentioned and the support of Richard Nixon. But also in 1970, after 64 years of trying, the Taos Pueblo people regained possession of Blue Lake. Explain why that was significant.
Well, Blue Lake was significant and is actually the last major action that Jackson was on the wrong side of. Blue Lake had been taken from the Taos Pueblo by the Forest Service, and by any legal measure, it was taken. It wasn't, it was something that was kind of an accident on a map. But to the Taos Pueblo, it was a sacred place. It was something that they never forgot and continued to have ceremonies and wanted it back. Clinton Anderson, the senator I mentioned earlier from New Mexico, had been Secretary of Agriculture and therefore in charge of the Forest Service, and was of the mind that you should never, ever, ever give back land, that once it's in the Forest Service, it's in the United States.
Because it would set a precedent?
Right. And he wanted to keep it that way forever. And he also didn't believe in tribal self-determination, so he was using that as well. But the Pueblos had such an impressive cause, and they were so steady in their leadership. They were, from 60 years, they just kept pressing and pressing. We want this land back. We know we're going to get this back. Well, that started to come to fruition in about 1968. They had convinced members of the House to support their cause, and they were able to get it through the Senate except for Clint Anderson's Interior Committee. And then when Jackson took over that committee, he too just shoved the bill off to the side and made sure that it never went anywhere. Well, there was a senator from Oklahoma by the name of Fred Harris who made this his cause to the point where he would attach a Pueblo rider to any bill going through the Senate. And he was going to bog down the entire Senate with a procedure. And so the Interior Committee did something they thought would sidestep the issue, is they let both bills come through the committee, which very rarely happens in Congress, and get to the floor. And once they got to the floor, they got wiped out. It was a very one-sided vote. One of the turning points was Barry Goldwater. They weren't sure what Barry Goldwater was going to do, but first in committee testimony and then on the floor of the Senate, Goldwater was incredibly eloquent about the First Amendment and the power of religion, and said the Pueblo's cause was that important, and spoke without notes, spoke from his heart. And once Barry Goldwater was over, I think they knew it was over. I interviewed John Ehrlichman many years ago about this, and he said it was probably the most interesting moment of the Nixon administration, where you have on the floor of the Senate Nixon lieutenants lobbying with George McGovern aides.
In that whole string of events, there was something called the Gentlemen's Club, which sounded like, I don't know, a holdover from the old South, maybe.
Yeah, the Senate was a very different place then. I mean, the idea of a colleague was a very powerful metaphor and one that really ran the institution. The Interior Committee was very much a part of that, where you really much had to be a Westerner to be on it and to have any juice. And you had to know how the game was played and treat people with respect. A couple of the senators in this book, Fred Harris and James Aberesk, when I talked to people from that past generation, they would dismiss them as someone who obviously only one-termers. They weren't going to make the Senate an institution. And whereas folks like Mike Mansfield and some of the others, they the Senate is what they lived and breathed. In fact, in the story, I talk about one Southern congressman who says that it's a great career to begin after all your other careers are done, and suggested that people wear a string tie.
Yeah, I think I remember the phrase, it was a good career to begin when you were 60.
Right.
One of the most notable ironies in your book, going back to Blue Lake, was that in this country that was founded on religious freedom, there were people trying as hard as they could not to allow the native people to have religious freedom.
Absolutely. In fact, what's fascinating about it, and is still sometimes an issue, is the groups that you would think would support that weren't. Environmental groups were against the tribe, and some of the national environmental groups were against the Pueblos. Some of the religious groups, actually, the religion kind of came around toward the end, especially, and was, I mean, Barry Goldwater captured that really well, that spirit. But it took somebody to articulate it. Before that, it wasn't the idea of a native religion getting the same First Amendment respect as other religions just wasn't there.
Because people didn't understand it, I guess, and didn't like rituals that were so different from their own.
Right, right. And yet the Pueblo have a history longer than most of the world.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Mark Trahant about his book titled The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars, Henry M. Jackson, Forrest J. Gerard, and the Campaign for the Self-Determination of America's Indian Tribes. We'll continue our conversation, and Mark will read an excerpt from the book right after a short break. Don't go away. There's one distinction you made that puzzled me a little bit. What's the difference between American Indians and Alaska Natives?
Alaska Natives tend to, and there's some exceptions to this, be more community-based than tribal-based. It's much more important where your village is and what village you're from in terms of then culture, in terms of fishing, where you have language that crosses many villages. American Indians are more tribal-based, where even the reservation skewed that a little bit, but it has more of an affiliation with that larger band or tribe. From the very inception of Alaska's statehood, the policymakers did not want to have Indian reservations in Alaska. And there is one, but they went out of their way to not let that system get replicated.
Was that because the reservation system had failed?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's also a protection of homelands. And so a reservation is a homeland. This was a winter ground for Shoshone and Bannock long before it was a reservation. So in that sense, it wasn't a failure.
If you don't mind reading the first few pages of the prologue, I think that will help explain the title of your book.
Okay. It's a preposterous title, The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars. How can that be? Depending on the definition, you could say the violent era of confrontation between American Indian tribes and the United States ended in southern Arizona on January 10, 1915. The Yaqui people had hoped to create an independent tribal state in northern Sonora and Mexico. Tribal warriors set up a base camp in Bear Valley, helping Yaquis travel back and forth across the Mexican border for employment or supplies. The commander at Fort Sam Houston telegraphed the War Department that a detachment of American cavalry sent into Bear Valley, 25 miles west of Nogales, to observe trails, clashed with a band of Yaqui Indians, captured 10, one of whom died in a hospital at Nogales. But even that was not the last battle. The 1960s and 1970s were full-length chronicles of skirmishes. Northwest tribal leaders insisted on their right to fish for salmon in the usual and accustomed places and manners as articulated by treaty. Yet state game wardens tear-gassed, beat, handcuffed, and arrested traditional fishermen. The situation escalated in 1964 when treaty fishers demonstrated with a fish in on Frank's Landing near Olympia, Washington. The war was on. Hundreds of Native people were arrested and ultimately vindicated when the Supreme Court in 1979 affirmed the Bolt decision, recognizing treaty rights. Billy Frank Jr., an Nisqually leader, told the Seattle Times, "The changes in the law, the Bolt decision, never would have happened without the fish-ins. We'd gone to see the U.S. attorney to get him to protect our treaty rights without results. Something more had to be done, and clearly it was done." The war metaphor is even more appropriate when considering the militancy during the late 1960s and 1970s. Boatloads of college students claimed Alcatraz Island on November 29, 1969, and held the rock for nearly 2 years. The American Indian Movement later claimed the spirit of those students when the organization used the images and words of a warrior society to convey its modern rebellion. The AIM campaign included a takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs headquarters in Washington, D.C., and the siege at Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Wounded Knee, the full story for another time, was complicated because tribal people were on both sides. Many tribal members saw their governments as reactionary. AIM to them was an inspiration and a force of justice. However, other tribal members supported their government. To the United States government, however, the Indian political divisions were confusing, and the policy was, and is, to support the elected tribal government. So machine guns were placed in front of tribal buildings, and the government did not seem to understand that it was taking side in a civil war. But it was a war, nonetheless. The U.S. Marshals called the Pentagon, and it was General Alexander Haig who, according to the book, like a hurricane, authorized the use of equipment and personnel. The military played a central role in determining government strategy, concealing its presence with simple yet brilliantly effective strategy of insisting that the colonels and generals sent to Pine Ridge wear civilian clothes at all times, wrote authors Paul Chatt Smith and Robert Allen Warrior. The AIM occupation of Wounded Knee lasted for 71 days and captured the world's attention. It also helped to shape the Hollywood image of a modern warrior still fighting for freedom. Today, movies such as Thunderheart celebrate that era. The film is a fictional account of a Lakota FBI agent who rediscovers his heritage and a sense of duty to his people. It's also interesting because a star of the movement, Dennis Banks, was one of the actors in the story that had loose ties to the Wounded Knee-like confrontation. Wounded Knee was its own last battle. AIM was never again as articulate or as militant about its mission. After Wounded Knee, AIM basically became another Indian organization instead of a movement. One could also accurately cite the 1975 Kootenai War in northern Idaho as the last great battle. A tiny landless tribe sued for war against the United States by selling war bonds and collecting dime tolls from roads that passed through the reservation. After 3 days, the war was over, without a shot being fired. The Kootenai won, and were given title to 10-plus acres for a reservation. War, conflict, and battles are part of our history, whether your point of view is that of Indian country or the United States itself. It's a continuing history. There will always be another battle, never an end. I think I've made the case against identifying any single event as the last great battle of the Indian Wars. Now consider this. The fight against termination and for self-determination was unlike any other war. The consequences of defeat meant tribal people would disappear and fade into an obscure category with other hyphenated Americans. Millions of Americans would check the census, as many do now, claiming Shoshone, Blackfeet, or Cherokee heritage. But American Indians and Alaska Natives are special in the eyes of the United States Constitution, the national discourse, and most important, within our own communities. The special nature was shaped by the campaign for self-determination. At the beginning of the 20th century, mainstream American politicians hoped that American Indians would simply disappear. The only logical political outcome was the end of American Indian tribal cultures.
Let's go back to Alaska for a minute and talk about how the discovery of the North Slope oil changed things.
Well, here you had a case where there was this massive oil discovery and nobody had title to the land. And you had Aboriginal claims. And the way it works is if there's an Aboriginal claim, you can't actually adjudicate how that land is going to be used until that claim is resolved. So the oil companies had a very, very big stake in making sure that there was some sort of title resolution as fast as possible. And the Alaska delegation wanted to unlock their riches, and so they were very keen on it. And it's an interesting role for Senator Jackson, because up until even now, I guess, Washington state senators are kind of like appendage senators for Alaska, even though Alaska has its own delegation. The ties between Seattle and Alaska are really great. And so it wasn't a surprise at all that a Washington senator jumped into this cause.
Because Jackson was from Washington.
Right. There's a fun story about Jackson that Walter Mondale told on the campaign trail. And that's that their pinnacle between their different roles in Congress, two Washington senators, Harry Magnuson and Scoop Jackson, had this enormous power. And Mondale joked that they were scrupulously fair. Half went to Washington and half went to the rest of the country.
So Alaska Natives were never subjected to the termination process.
No, Alaska Natives had their own challenges. And prior to statehood, they just didn't really have anything. There was a couple of Bureau of Indian Affairs schools, but In the book, I tell about Darcy McNichol, who was a self-trained anthropologist that worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Native. And he went on a tour of Alaska and was just stunned by the lack of infrastructure from the federal government.
Can you clarify the relationship between sovereign American Indian governments and the federal government of the United States?
Sure. Well, a couple of points. One is globally, it's not an issue. There are sovereigns within sovereigns all the time. In fact, probably the most famous is Scotland. And as Scotland goes through devolution, it actually is pressing this issue internationally much more, where the idea of what a sovereign state is up for debate. In the United States, I think it's partly education, because the Constitution itself recognizes tribes as sovereigns. in a couple of ways. One, it talks about with the Commerce Clause that tribes and the states. So clearly there was the idea that tribes had inherent powers. But the second is that in the role of treaties, it talks about treaties as supreme law of the land. And most of the treaties, when the Constitution was written, weren't with European powers, they were with tribes.
So where are we now with termination and the process of self-determination?
To me, the most inspiring story of self-determination is, again, in Alaska. And so this is people that came to the whole idea rather late. And that's the Alaska public health system, Native public health system. In the United States, in the lower 48, about half the tribes have federal government clinics or federal government hospitals where the government, through the treaty obligation, provides a service. In Alaska, they said, we don't want to do that. We want the whole thing. We're going to run the system ourselves, and we're going to make it work to our advantage. And at the Alaska Native Medical Center, when they started to build it, they started to ask their folks, what do you really want in a health system? And people would say things like, well, you know, when I go to the doctor, I have to wait a long time. I really don't like that. I'd like to get in, do what I have to do, and get out. So they designed the entire system around that idea. So they have multiple waiting rooms that are small. You go in. There are signs that say, if you haven't seen someone in 15 minutes, something's wrong, talk to us. They built the system around what people want. And now that this has happened, the results from a medical point of view have just been outstanding. Fewer hospital admissions, fewer return visits, more self-care, everything you want in a hospital at a fraction of what the rest of the United States spends. And to me, that's real self-determination, is to say, here's how we want to make our system that works for us, and then make it better.
That's amazing. Just because people will now seek medical help earlier.
Right. They'll manage their own care. Three-quarters of American healthcare is chronic disease. So if you can get people to manage their own care, you're going to drive costs down. I think what so much of this boils down to, and again gets into this recognition of what is a sovereign, is what it takes to be a good neighbor. And in southern Idaho here, and in fact, all of Idaho, the tribes are really major employers. They're really great neighbors. They're doing all kinds of things, whether it's fish recovery. I mean, to me, one of the stories that came out of the fish wars in the 1960s and 70s was that when tribes got their right to fish, they immediately started putting money into resource improvement. And then now there's more fish for everybody. And when they were fighting over a scarce resource, there was less fish for everybody. So it shows to me the power of working together and being a good neighbor. For tiny governments, tribes put enormous resources into fish recovery.
Mark Trahant lives on the Shoshone-Bannock Indian Reservation in Fort Hall, Idaho, and has just been appointed Atwood Chair at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. There's more information about him at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, links to our podcast, Facebook page, and Huvia Edwards and John Floridas, who wrote and performed the music you heard during this program.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.